From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Austin Cross in for A. Martinez. Governor Newsom catches heat as California tops New York for the most coronavirus cases. Meanwhile, a new podcast shines a spotlight on successful Black women in the film industry.
Not only did we want to show that these women are already here, but also we want young girls, young women to feel inspired.
It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app, this is Take Two. I'm Austin Cross in for A. Martinez. Thanks for joining us this Friday. Coming up.
Y'all turn them headlights on if you got them. Let's do it like this.
Live concerts in your car. It's a thing, I promise you. We'll be talking about it in about 45 minutes. Stick around. It's well worth the wait. But we start today with State of Affairs. That's our weekly look at politics in the Golden State. And this week, it's been just over 100 days since Governor Newsom unveiled his star-studded economic task force with the goal of leading the state's economic recovery. So why can't it solve the reopening? Meanwhile, as job losses continue to mount here, a lot of people are bracing for life after the federal benefit runs out at the end of the month. We'll check in on those negotiations in Washington. With us this week is Marisa Lagos, political correspondent for KQED. Welcome, Marisa.
Hey, good to be with you, Austin.
Also with us is Zach Corser. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome to you, Zach.
Hey, Austin. Great to be with you.
Governor Newsom's task force, Marisa, boasts some pretty big names. You've got Apple's Tim Cook, Disney's Bob Iger, even former Fed Chair Janet Yellen. But 100 days in, what have we seen from this task force?
I mean, publicly, quite frankly, not a ton. The governor's office says that they are meeting in smaller committees and are giving the governor sort of constant updates. But, you know, there's been no white paper, not that that's the only thing a task force can do. And we really haven't heard a lot. To your point, even as we sort of open up and then shut back down in fits and starts, I think that a lot of people were expecting when he named this, you know, panel full of luminaries that they would be coming out with real clear guidance maybe a little sooner.
Zach, critics say the public has largely been kept in the dark on this task force. And it's worth noting that since Governor Newsom unveiled it, California attempted a pretty unsuccessful reopening. I'm curious what you expected from this task force 100 days ago. And then I want to know why things are the way they are now, in your view.
Well, actually, I remember listening to the press conference where this was announced on KPCC.
Ah.
And I was thinking to myself, you know, what should we expect? And really what I thought, you know, as a lot of sort of blue ribbon commissions, you know, that bring together the best and the brightest to look at a problem, that we would have at a certain point received a roadmap of some kind, a public document, whether it's a white paper or something that's more digestible by the public in general, that tried to map out, you know, California's path through this pandemic. And obviously that has not been forthcoming. Some have complained that there's, you know, been a lack of transparency or it's too insular. But I think one of the challenges is I think they took on too broad a remit. You know, one of the subcommittees they had for this was climate change and innovation. And those are important issues, but I don't know if they're fully focused on the problem at hand. So I think maybe a narrower focus and definition of what the problem was they were working on might have helped them make a little more progress towards producing something like a roadmap that people could understand.
Well, Marisa, if California's best and brightest are struggling to save the world's fifth largest economy, then I imagine it's considerably harder to manage the nation as a whole. Now, President Trump has largely left states to fend for themselves during this crisis. And I'm wondering, do you have any reason to believe that more federal support would have actually aided this task force in their mission?
I mean, absolutely. I think there's no question if Congress had come through with some of the aid that states have been asking for across the nation, I think both red and blue states have been asking for to help backfill the budget. I think it could have given the governor and state leaders more breathing room. And maybe they could have thought a little more carefully about whether to reopen bars before they had a plan for schools. I think we can't underscore how much the sort of fiscal uncertainty has made it more difficult at both the state and local level to attack this. I mean, to your point, it is a huge issue and a difficult one for the feds as well. But they have a lot of tools that states don't have. And I think that you know, we have to kind of continue talking about that. And the fact that really, you know, on a less sort of concrete place, but the messaging from the top has been so mixed that I think that did make it a lot harder for people like Newsom when they did decide to put in mask mandates and things like that to really make sure that all of their, you know, the population in California was willing to follow those rules.
Zach, what do you think?
I think leadership was needed as much or more than more federal dollars. And I totally agree with Marissa that mixed messaging from the top and a lack of a plan from the feds really did contribute to a difficulty, not just in California, but I think across the country, to understand the outlines of this pandemic, what the response should be, coordination. I mean, I remember back to talking about the governor, you know, virtually begging the Trump administration for certain, you know, PPE and other certain sorts of aid. And he was very careful to not offend the president because there was such a political battle in Michigan in particular with Gretchen Whitmer, where she, you know, Trump wanted to fight about this rather than cooperate and collaborate with states and find a federal cooperative strategy on this pandemic.
Marissa, Governor Newsom has been widely regarded as one of the nation's leaders in the fight against coronavirus because he did issue the nation's first stay-at-home order, for example. He announced billions of dollars worth of deals for PPE. Obviously, not all of those deals went well, though. But as California now tops New York for the most coronavirus cases, I think a lot of people are wondering right now, what went wrong? So you've been watching the Newsom timeline on all of this. What have you seen, and in your opinion or in your view or from what you've seen, was it a premature reopening?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that hindsight's 20/20, so it's easy for me to sit here and second guess. But I do think the governor did bend to political pressure. We've seen really good reporting about the fact that they didn't always follow their own data and guidelines around those reopenings. I think there's a few other things here as well. You know, a lot of this handling this pandemic has been sort of shifting our psychology around it. And I think it's human nature to expect the best and hope for the best. I think we elect, you know, people like the governor and the president to plan for the worst. I think there's a second element here, though, too, which is we have a very sort of devolved set of powers in California. We give a lot of powers to locals, to counties, to school districts. And I think sometimes that works really well, as in the fact that the Bay Area shut down first as we were seeing cases here mount. But it also means that there's a lot of variance around the state, and it can be really hard, back to that messaging issue and just the fact that, you know, the virus does not respect county lines, even if counties are handling things differently.
Now, Zach, I want to keep in mind that this is new ground for everyone. And I don't think that anyone could have predicted, say, back in January, that California would be shelling out $315 million on N95 respirators. And, you know, hospital rooms aren't overwhelmed either, which means something about the state response is going right. But I want to get your take on this, too. What's gone wrong, and why aren't we in a better place with this virus right now?
Yeah, it's a big question. I think we're all struggling to sort of figure out how is it that California has zoomed to be number one for corona in the United States. And of course, it's one of the reasons is because we're such a very large state. You know, we can't forget the size and scale of California. But I also think it's political and it's cultural. I think, you know, the culture of not wearing masks and this desire to return to life as normal, you know, it grew up, I think, in reaction to what was happening in the White House in certain quarters of the state and certain counties. I think the polarization of the issue has contributed to the lack of compliance that we've observed. And I think we've overcorrected. I mean, I think it's clear, you know, yeah, like Marissa said, hindsight's 20/20, but we may have gone to something that many people consider too stringent to something that's way too lax. And it's really hard, I think, to manage that culture and response to the pandemic. And so we're struggling. I mean, New York City really had a tough experience, much tougher than we have so far. And I hope California never has the same kind of death and destruction that was visited in New York. But I think New York learned a very hard lesson there. And I think we need to instill the idea that of the consequences of not complying with what I think are reasonable expectations for, say, wearing masks.
And just in case anybody's wondering, I'm looking at it right now. California, 409,000 cases, eclipsing New York's 408,886. This is State of Affairs. I'm Austin Cross, sitting in for A. Martinez. Marisa Lagos is with me. She's political correspondent for KQED. Also with me is Zach Corser. He co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. And Marisa, moving on, millions of Americans could soon lose an economic lifeline. And that's the $600 a week in pandemic unemployment assistance that came about as a result of the CARES Act. But that money is set to run out at the end of the month now, unless Congress acts. Where do negotiations stand right now?
It's getting hot out there in D.C. So, you know, the House did pass a bill back a few months ago that would expand this, a $3 trillion bill. The Senate has not taken it up. And just as of the last hour or so, we've heard that Republicans are pushing for a sort of short-term stopgap measure so that, you know, the unemployment doesn't fall off that cliff. And Pelosi, the House Speaker, Democrat, is rejecting that, saying it needs to be a broader package. I think she feels that they don't, you know, they shouldn't have the political cover of kind of doing that because Democrats want to see a lot more money in there for states and local governments to deal with some of the fiscal problems we've talked about. They want more money for testing and contact tracing, things that, you know, experts say can actually help us get this pandemic under control. So I would imagine there's going to be a lot of conversations over the weekend, and this is going to keep developing. And, you know, just like the legislature, Austin, they're like teenagers. They always wait until the last minute.
Yeah. Don't we know that to be the truth? And Zach, GOP leaders have largely dismissed the $3 trillion coronavirus relief package that's been pushed by Democrats, with many arguing that some people are making more money on unemployment insurance than they would at their normal jobs. And Senator Lindsey Graham has said that he's willing to make an extension, but he'd want to see the model change for that, for those payments. You're our policy guy, so I want to ask, is there a model that you think Republicans would get behind that would also provide the aid that at least 30 million Americans need right now?
Well, you know, we remember that Lindsey Graham opposed the $600 bonus back when we were talking about the last relief package. And mm-hmm. he represents, I think, opinion coming from employers in the business sector. And there's some ideas out there. Rob Portman from Ohio has floated this idea that the U.S. Chamber and other business interests have put out there where you try to incentivize going back to work. Basically, you would get a $450 a week bonus if you return to work by a certain date. It's kind of incentivizing people to work. Democrats have talked about the idea of, you know, not having this fall off a cliff, but perhaps phasing it in over time, or phasing it out, rather, I should say. Ron Wyden from Oregon has talked about we should have some kind of economic trigger that's responsive to changing economic conditions so that when conditions improve or they get worse, there will be a change or adjustment in the supplement to unemployment. And then Georgia right now, which is a Republican state, you know, they have one innovation that some people have talked about. They're allowing part-time work without reduction in benefits. They've set a level to where if you do part-time work to up to $300 a week, it will not reduce your benefits. And so it's another idea that's out there. There are ideas if people are willing to listen to modify this plan.
But I'm really curious, Marisa, we've dealt with fiscal cliffs before. This one will obviously hit home for a lot more people. Do you have any reason to hope that a deal might be reached soon?
I think probably, although we never like to make predictions in this business anymore. But like I said, I mean, this is a pressure that's coming from across the nation. This is not unique, again, to Democrats, Republicans. I think that there is certainly some signs of willingness to play ball, and I would expect it will take a while. I also want to, you know, respond to this whole issue of people not wanting to go back to work because they're making so much money on unemployment.
Sure.
I feel like we need to talk about whether people feel safe going back to work. You may make that choice because you feel like I am able to pay my rent or my mortgage and I don't feel safe going back to work. And so it seems to me that that needs to be part of the conversation too, is how to protect employees, employers, and make sure that workplaces can be safe and we can do this in a way that makes sense for everyone.
Zach, really quickly for you, deal soon or no?
I think it has to happen. I think, you know, as the pressure mounts and as the time moves on, as we get closer to the August recess, I think Congress has got to act. And so I think, as usual, it'll probably be something that nobody's happy with. It's a compromise. But I think we will see a package. I think it's likely to be north of $1 trillion. I think the GOP will probably have to give on this idea of, like, you know, a barrier, like we can't go more than $1 trillion. I think they'll probably have to back down on that.
Last thing today, I really want to squeeze it in because I thought it was really interesting when I read it. A presumptive Democratic nominee, Joe Biden, is in the process of choosing his running mate. But throughout that process, the political terrain has actually shifted considerably as polling now shows him taking a much stronger lead over President Trump. Marisa, with just a couple seconds left, the LA Times does make the case that Biden is under less pressure to maybe choose a game changer. If you remember game changers in the past, like Sarah Palin, maybe somebody who would unite the party. Do you see that being the case, or is this maybe just a theory?
I think it's partly true because, and not just because of the polling, which I think will tighten, but essentially because Biden has been able to unite Democrats far more than we might have expected just a few months ago when it was still a slog between him and Bernie and 10 other candidates. So I think that Biden is in a good place, and I think he's probably going to pick someone he feels the most comfortable with.
Marisa Lagos co-hosts the podcast Political Breakdown for KQED. Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Zach, Marisa, have a great and safe weekend.
You too, Austin.
Coming up, we've talked a lot now about the economic effects that coronavirus shutdowns have had on the state. And add to that, there are still a lot of questions about the virus and what we might expect. And listeners like you have sent us a lot of questions about it. And there's also been a lot of news. So in just a minute, we're going to get some answers from Professor Paula Cannon. She's a virologist at USC's Keck School of Medicine. Stay with us.
Understand me now. Sometimes I feel a little mad. But don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm Austin Cross, sitting in for A. Martinez. Closed, then open, then closed again. You could get whiplash from how quickly things are changing in our county due to the coronavirus pandemic. There's a lot we don't have control over, but there's also a lot that we can do. So let's focus on that and answer your questions with Professor Paula Cannon. She's with the Department of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at USC's Keck School of Medicine. Professor, welcome back to the program.
Hey, hi there, Austin.
I just want to start off by asking about the current state of the coronavirus guidelines in place for the county, because I've been looking through some listener submissions, Professor, and believe it or not, there was a good amount of confusion on this front. What should we know?
Oh, I can totally believe there's confusion. So the last update was about 10 days ago from the California Department of Public Health, and your listeners can always go to their website for the latest information. But basically, they changed their recommendations because we were starting to see this uptick in cases statewide. And I think what's confusing is there's sort of two sets of guidelines. First of all, the guidelines for everybody, and that's sort of no bars, no indoor restaurants or other indoor venues. But then there's also some restrictions that are on what they call the counties of concern on the monitoring list. And, you know, LA County is on that list. And that also extends the restrictions to gyms and churches and malls and hairdressing salons. So we're also restricted from going into those.
Now, we've been hearing for weeks now about this surge in cases. Can you help us make sense of those numbers a little bit? For example, what can it be traced to?
Sure. Well, I think it's several reasons. First, certainly, there's been a marked increase in younger people getting infected, the sort of 18 to 30-year-olds. And that's been attributed, frankly, to people going out and having a summer and getting together in places where, you know, you take off a mask to eat or drink. And I think it's also probably been exacerbated by the fact that in that group of people, you know, people can have no or mild symptoms and so can be unaware that they are spreading the virus. But then in addition, we're also seeing some hotspots now in communities, especially Latino communities and areas where you're more likely to have essential workers, grocery workers, healthcare workers, and people living in denser, multi-generational communities. So those are probably the two big reasons.
Let's turn now to a question that's been submitted anonymously by a listener. They ask, how many COVID-19 patients who have recovered within LA County or who have recovered within LA County? I see new cases and deaths all the time. How many have recovered?
Oh, Lordy, that's really difficult math to do. Part of the challenge is we actually don't know how many people have truly been infected. We have a number. It's about 167, I think, today of people who've had a positive test. But the true number of people who've been infected and therefore have recovered is going to be higher than that. And then in addition, the other thing that's tricky is, although most people who get this virus will kind of recover within, say, 14 days, the disease can have a long tail in other people and they can go many weeks before they're out of the woods. So it's also hard to know when you can call somebody as being recovered. So that's the challenge with coming up with that number.
So let's say hypothetically someone caught the coronavirus and had COVID-19. This is for our next question. Our listener, Edie Rossmeisel, asks the question, should they no longer be concerned that they could catch the virus or are they contagious?
Sure. So that's an interesting question. And, you know, the current guidelines from the CDC are that you should consider yourself infectious and isolate yourself for at least 10 days after your symptoms start, and for at least 3 days after your symptoms have ended. But even after that, there is a concern that even if you've had the virus and you've, you know, developed immunity, we don't know how long that immunity will last. It could start to wane over time, and that could make you susceptible to a second infection. So I think to play it safe, you should not consider yourself immune just because you've had the virus once, and you should certainly consider yourself contagious for at least sort of, you know, 10 to 14 days after you start to get the symptoms.
And keeping with that, Professor, I want to ask you about a study that was recently released by UCLA researchers. It shows that among those who recovered from a mild case of COVID-19, their antibodies actually fell off after about 3 months or so. So how should we consider these findings, and what might it mean for improved immunity against the virus or for an effective vaccine even?
Yeah, that was a great study by my friends over at UCLA, Otto Yang and Grace Aldrovandi. Yes, even though I'm at USC, I can credit them. because what they did was they actually measured the rate of antibody decline over time. And they found that in the group of patients who'd had mild symptoms, their antibodies were going down by half about every 36 days. Now, we don't really know what to make of that information because we don't yet know if there is a sort of a minimum amount of antibody that you would need in your blood to stay protected. But it's probable, you know, that this would be of concern. And the same concern, this, you know, antibodies going down over time from a natural infection are also going to be concerns for vaccines. You know, if a vaccine mimics an infection and makes antibodies, it'll be important that those antibodies last. And, you know, one of the tricks that vaccine developers and pediatricians use is sometimes they'll give you two shots of a vaccine to kind of boost that immunity. You know, it's not just, you know, it's not just to make your kids cry twice. So we may be seeing with these, you know, with these vaccines that, you know, having two shots as like a booster really helps to preserve, you know, immunity over time.
We're talking with Professor Paula Cannon. She's a virologist at USC's Keck School of Medicine. And Professor, I want to bring up this concept of herd immunity for a second, as we did receive a few questions along that theme. A listener who identified themselves as H. Kreshmar asks, there is so much talk about herd immunity, but my understanding is that research is not conclusive about whether people could be infected more than once by COVID-19. If a person can get reinfected, how can we achieve herd immunity? So, Professor, just to put it to you in a more straightforward way, if herd immunity is hypothetically unachievable. Could this virus maybe embed itself in our society forever, and therefore we'd maybe need seasonal vaccines against it?
Yeah. And, you know, even if vaccines worked really well or natural immunity worked really well, you're still going to, you know, have this concept that we need to maintain a high level of people being immune to the virus, you know, like measles, you know, that's been around forever. And we have really good vaccines against measles. But if everybody doesn't take the vaccine, then you will get these hotspots. So I think with this virus, you know, it looks right now that it's probably going to be with us for a long time. Hopefully we're going to get, you know, vaccines soon, and that's going to, you know, stop people getting infected and getting really sick. But I don't see it leaving the human race for anytime soon.
Well, I don't think anybody wanted to hear that today. But since you mentioned vaccines, I do want to get an update on that. What is the latest on the vaccine news?
Okay, well, I would say it's actually really good news.
Okay.
There you go. So in the last week or so, there's been four different trials that have reported pretty promising results in terms of, you know, developing antibodies and also the other arm of our immune response, which is called a T-cell response. And two of these trials have been based on what we called RNA vaccines, and two of them have instead been based on a sort of a weakened virus, a weakened common cold virus. And in all four cases, they are delivering the just the spike protein of the virus, which is that little red blob you see on the outside of the kind of cartoons of the virus. So I think they look good because pretty much everybody who got these, you know, very different types of vaccines has developed antibodies. So, you know, now they're marching straight ahead into doing these larger trials where they can hopefully actually start to identify whether or not people who've had their test vaccines are, you know, protected.
And Paula, for my last question, I want to return to a favorite topic of ours here on Take Two. Last night, a listener left us a voicemail. This is that voicemail.
I'm a listener member. My name's Leslie Spencer. I live in Thousand Palms, which is east of Palm Springs in the Coachella Valley. People are not wearing a mask. They go into a Costco or another store that has a mask policy, and they have their nose sticking out. And that's not wearing a mask. And we can't turn this around. We can't protect our children. What is so hard about wearing a mask?
So clearly a lot of frustration there on that one, Paula. What does the research say about masks and why they matter in the fight against COVID-19? And what is one thing that you would say to maybe help persuade those who are unconverted?
Okay, so I would say think of a mask as the one piece of good news about this virus, because this virus only spreads efficiently when it's kind of coated in what we call a respiratory droplet. So I like a little bubble of saliva. So I think of it as like an alien in a spaceship, and this salivary droplet keeps it warm and safe as it travels the hostile, you know, airspace between people. So if you wear a mask, you know, you're either going to be trapping that particle inside your own mask if you're infected, or importantly, if you wear a mask, you're also going to be blocking those little aliens getting into your own nose and mouth. So I would say to people, you know, be selfish. We've now got very clear data that masks protect you as well as protecting everybody else. So a mask can keep you healthy and working and enjoying the summer until we get to our vaccine. I think we're more than halfway there towards getting a vaccine. So go ahead, get a cute little mask, wear it. You can do this.
Professor Paul Cannon, can I just say, I just love having you on, because the way that you put things, it just really helps, really helps with understanding. So thank you so much for that.
Welcome.
Professor
You're
Paula
welcome.
Cannon is with the Department of Molecular Microbiology and Immunology at USC's Keck School of Medicine. And if I didn't thank you enough already, thank you for your time. Well, if you consume a lot of media and literature, chances are you've heard about the concept of the male gaze. That's the act of depicting women and the world from a masculine and heterosexual perspective. But have you heard of the white gaze? Well, it's just one of the concepts that I talk about with the hosts of the new podcast, Sister Brunch, which puts a spotlight on women of color working in the entertainment industry. I'm really looking forward to it. Stick around.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC, and you can also get the Take Two podcast wherever you like to listen. I'm Austin Cross, sitting in today for A. Martinez. And speaking of podcasts, my next guests are the hosts of the new podcast, Sista Brunch. Each episode is a deep dive conversation with a woman of color working in entertainment or media. The hosts are Anya Adams and Fanchon Cox. Adams is a TV director who worked on Glow and Black-ish, among other shows. She recently won an NAACP award for directing. Cox is a producer and development executive with Matt Damon and Ben Affleck's company, Pearl Street Films. Anya and Fanchon, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you.
I'm pinching myself. I'm just going to say that. This is amazing. Thank you so much.
Me too. Yeah.
I dare say I'm equally excited. And you often start your interviews by going back to the beginning. So I actually want to turn that around on you now and ask you how your podcast came to be and why you decided to call it Sista Brunch. And Anya, I'll start with you.
Well, I came into the industry through the DGA trainee program, and that's really where I first came in contact with a Sista Brunch. And essentially what it was women of color that were working as assistant directors on film and television who had mentors. Their mentors would kind of pull their mentees and the other mentors together and bring us together for a Sista Brunch, an opportunity for us to just come together and talk about our experiences and what we were learning and what things we might have questions or problems with. And it just kind of started to grow from there. And so we'd been going for a long time, and I had met Fanchon and I invited her, and she can tell you her experience when she sat in my backyard. But
yeah, it was, I was just coming off of a major push for studios and for our production company at Pearl Street Films to use the inclusion rider that I co-authored with Kalpana Kodagal and Stacey Smith. And so here I was starting to see what kind of pushback we were going to get on the inclusion rider. And one of the biggest things we were getting was, you're going to force us to hire all these people, but they don't exist. Where are we supposed to find them? It's not fair. And so I sit in Anya's backyard, lovely backyard, with all of these amazing women of color working in the industry in all kinds of different jobs. And I was like, they're right here. There is no lack of women to hire. And so I think I called Anya, I don't know, a couple of weeks later and was like, we need to make a podcast so that people know who these women are.
Yeah. And I was so excited about it because one of the things for me is I had, you know, coming into this industry, I didn't know anything about assistant directing. I didn't know anything about that. And to be able to find a way to create a platform to share all the different types of jobs that women of color could jump into, but they had no access to or no knowledge of, was really exciting to me. And so, you know, when Fanchon said that, I was like, absolutely, let's get on it. I know 100 people already. We had, our list was like so long from the beginning. So,
and Fanchon, I was actually going to ask you about that inclusion writer later, and I definitely will. Well, one thing that I really want to ask, because you've kind of explained beautifully how this came to be, would you say that there is a mission overall that guides you as you create this podcast?
Yes, more. We not only did we want to show that these women are already here, but also we want young girls, young women to listen to the podcast and feel inspired to become a part of the industry in any of the ways that our guests are sharing their stories about, and introduce them to new ideas. Let's say someone might love theater, and this is a great way to find out what kinds of skills do you have working in the theater that might transfer over into the skills of people that work in film and TV and streaming. So yeah, it is to encourage and inspire and women who otherwise may not think that they could do this to know that they can.
And also to really share their origin stories, to understand the process and the ways and the many myriad of different ways it takes to get to where, like, to get to be a director. You know, it's not just school, it's not just, you know, indies, it's like all these different ways that people have done things. And the other thing I think, like, that we were so excited about this the podcast was like the opportunity to highlight like the loader. What does the loader do for Cameron? How has that changed now that we don't have film? And like finding women of color that are doing that, and then what was their journey to get there? It's like, those are things that are like, just we get geeked out about, because it's like these obscure positions that no one knows about, but oh my gosh, like how cool are they? Or, you know.
Our guests are the host of the podcast Sister Brunch, Anya Adams and Fanchon Cox. And Fanchon, you are credited for co-authoring that inclusion writer, so I just want to be really sure that people understand what it is. Could you possibly kind of explain how the inclusion writer works?
Oh yes, happily. So we wanted to find a way for A-list actors like Matt and Ben to have some negotiating power in their contracts with studios. So it's a writer in the same way that one actor may say, I want to have Doritos in my trailer. This one says, I want the cast and crew of this project to reflect what the world looks like. From there, we can tailor it again based on story sovereignty, and we can tailor it based on the right now with COVID. There are some obviously some other things to keep in mind around hiring, but it is really specifically about targeting qualified people who will represent a broader view of what the world actually looks like in cast and crew.
And you mentioned this earlier, but you and your co-authors faced a lot of pushback with this writer. And I'm wondering, what do you think was behind that pushback that you faced?
I wish that we could use past tense. We still face a lot of pushback. I think, you know, on a macro level, it's systemic racism, systemic, you know, sexism. It's all the things that have maintained the status quo in the industry. And people get scared, and we see it across the country in other ways as well, that afraid that it means that they're going to lose jobs, versus us saying this is a win for everyone, right? Diversifying what these sets look like is a win for everyone. But on a smaller level, the kinds of things we hear, one, as I mentioned, we can't find people. And unfortunately, we've heard also just, no, we're not going to do it. I don't know how to make that a euphemistic answer, but.
But I do feel like with the shift in the culture in the country right now, people that are also in power and able to, you know, actors and producers that may not have spoken up now feel a little bit more empowered. So I feel like there's an energy shift that's happening that I think is going to bring the inclusion writer to the forefront a lot more.
I think that energy shift is definitely being felt in a lot of different media industries, even, you know, within the media industry that I'm in. I mean, I think it's definitely being felt, and especially over the past few months.
Yeah.
And so
I'm glad we have a Black person hosting this today.
That's so nice.
I'm sorry.
Well, you know, something I wanted to actually ask you about, because I'd never actually heard it put this way before, is in your interview with Elon Washington, who's the development manager for Jordan Peele's Monkey Paw Productions, and your conversation centered around this concept of the white gaze, which is something that I guess I kind of knew existed, but I didn't have the term for it. I didn't actually have the word for it. I'm wondering if you could tell us, you know, how you would define it and how it makes its way into the production process, especially for a person of color who's developing something that they want, you know, a wider audience to see.
I mean, it's a wider audience, but also like just your perspective, like as a filmmaker coming in and having a perspective as a person of color, when you're talking to somebody that doesn't have the same perspective and they're unwilling to let go of their old traditions, beliefs, thoughts on people of color, then it's very hard to, you know, create the project that you want. So like if you think about like, If somebody has a preconceived notion that Black people are poor, you know, then highlighting a Black family of affluence and having that conversation with them about how to do it and why you want to, it's hard for them to get past that. So that's like a totally mundane example, but
because from the beginning of film, media entertainment has reflected the white experience. We, people of color, we know that story. And we sometimes fall into the trap of creating our own stories in a way that would be appealing to that, because in some ways it's all we know. It's the only stories we've had. And so that pressure of the white gaze both comes from us wanting to tailor our stories to make them more palatable to white folks, and also from them, you know, from white folks who don't recognize our experiences.
Well, I want to close actually by asking your recommendations, because my understanding now, based off of what I've heard from you two, is that for those people who are the money people, if they don't have it within them, if they don't have a way to measure and to understand these experiences that are maybe being brought to them that are totally valid, that even hold the potential for them to, you know, be very successful pieces of media, if they are released, because there are so many people out there who are not represented, who would be so refreshed to hear a story told from a different perspective, from a perspective that has not actually gotten a lot of voice and a lot of amplification in the industry. I'm wondering from both of you what recommendations you would make to the industry to expand, to include more people of color, and in particular, women.
I think you have to believe that, you know, if you find something that resonates with you in the story, step back and let the filmmaker, let the storyteller tell the story, and don't try to jump in and correct or manipulate it to make it satisfy your feelings.
What we really need to do is to get women of color into the executive suites, into the decision-making positions, because again, it's back to that question of the white gaze. If you don't know it, you don't know it, and it's not necessarily your fault, but you are limited in that. And we need folks that look like us and have shared some of our experiences with sexism and racism and know what intersectionality means to be in those positions to acknowledge that these stories need to be told. So that's my next project.
Preach!
But yeah, we're going to get on that.
I was hoping that a preach or some snaps would make it into this, because that's one of my...
I'm snapping.
Well, Fanchen Cox and Anya Adams are the hosts of Sister Brunch. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Thank you both so much for making the time. It's been so fun.
Thanks for having us.
Have a great day.
Remember concerts, live music? Yeah, me too. But there is hope. In just a minute, I'm going to talk to the man behind Concerts in Your Car. It's everything you're imagining right now and more. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm Austin Cross, in for A. Martinez. The pandemic has shut down nearly everything that could involve big crowds. That includes going to see live music. But event producers have figured out that where there's a will and there are wheels, there's a way.
Y'all turn them headlights on if you got them. Let's do it like this.
That's singer Randy Houser performing a live concert in Ventura just weeks ago, and he's doing it in front of a crowd who are all in their cars. It's part of a drive-in series at the Ventura County Fairgrounds called Concerts in Your Car, and it's one of the ways that musicians and fans can be together while staying physically distant. To tell us more, we have Vincenzo Giamanco, founder and CEO of CBF Productions, which produces Concerts in Your Car. Vincenzo, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You've had years of experience producing outdoor concerts, but then March came along. How did the pandemic affect your plans for 2020?
You know, we had a great 2019. And when this happened in March, I was talking to my team and I'm like, hey, you know, maybe we should push our event that we had in March back a couple weeks. And somebody's like, no, we should maybe do it a month, thinking that this would all be past us. Mm. And now we're still living in it. You know, we're in July. It was devastating. I mean, it basically shut us down. I had to furlough all my employees and really kind of take a step back and figure out how we can reinvent ourselves.
I'm wondering, where did you get the idea to use the drive-in format as a way to revive concerts?
You know, at that point, I had the realization that my whole year might be scrapped. You know, this is how I feed my family. This is all I know how to do. And me and my wife were driving around in March during the quarantine, and we drove by the Ventura County Fairgrounds, that big open parking lot. And we just say, why don't we do a concert in your car? One thing led to another, and it just kind of snowballed. And I made phone calls to some of my partners in the industry, and I called the fairgrounds and I said, what are you guys doing? And their fair got canceled. And so they were very open to it. And it was definitely a team effort that kind of came together to make what it is today.
Now, when people go, describe the layout of the cars and the stage for me, if you could.
Yeah. So originally, when you go to a concert, you put a stage at one end of the field and you have your VIP section and, you know, it kind of goes mm-hmm. back. But knowing that it was in our car, we wanted to create an experience that people would just love. And so the stage is set in the center of the venue and cars are parked 360 degrees around the venue. Everybody is able to see the stage from their vehicle. We have big LED screens above the stage, so we're able to cut to different shots and people are able to really get a great view.
And compared to the other more traditional concerts you've produced, how many people can you fit into a venue right now?
Well, we went from 20,000 people in a confined space to now 675 cars. I mean, that's basically, and I don't know, the thing is we charge per car, not per person. As long as you have a seatbelt and a seat, that's fine. And there's families that come that, six people. So it's definitely interesting because you have this parking lot filled and these artists performing and you have thousands of people there, but they're really, you don't even see them.
I'm talking to Vincenzo Giammanco, founder and CEO of CBF Productions, which produces concerts in your car. Now, in the coming weeks, you'll have acts like Third Eye Blind, Fits and the Tantrums, and Sublime. How did you persuade these bands to be a part of this?
When we first started, it was a struggle. I mean, it's a concept, and until you saw it, it was hard to see the vision. But I had acts like Super Duper Kyle and Randy Houser that just saw it and believed in what we were doing and just said, yes, let's do it. And as soon as we had proof of concept, it was like the floodgates opened and now acts are calling us to perform. And normally we wouldn't even be entertaining this level of entertainment at the moment, just because one, with feasibility and affordability, one, but also just they're so busy. So it took a pandemic to make this happen, but we're really excited to have these people. And I can't wait to see who comes across the stage.
I'm really wondering, has this been a profitable venture for you? Or is this kind of like just a way, like a lot of people are trying to figure out right now, a way to stay afloat?
I got the PPP loan. This is a complete gamble and a Hail Mary. Nobody's getting rich off of this kind of stuff. Like I said, we went from 20,000 people to 675 cars. I don't know. I mean, really, it's just keeping the lights on, keeping people employed, and getting us through this. This is definitely a temporary solution to a temporary problem, and we're just trying to make the best of it. But it's just so rewarding when you see the look on people's faces and the families that are able to get together that they thought their summer was and fun was canceled, and it's not canceled, and we can do it in a socially safe way, and we're just excited to bring that to the community.
One last thing, Vincenzo, this drive-in concert idea, it's something that can be seen all over the world at this point, but several weeks ago, we also talked with one of the main organizers trying to keep indoor concert venues alive during this time. So I guess I'm kind of curious, you're not trying to replace them or traditional outdoor concerts, right?
No. And I think it's funny when people, they're just trying to get us used to this. And it's like, no, this is a new experience that you should definitely check out. And does this exist post pandemic? I don't know. We all want to get back to normal and back to the way we used to. But right now we're just getting through a pandemic, I guess the only way we know how.
Vincenzo Giammanco, founder and CEO of CBF Productions, which produces Concerts in Your Car. It's a series at the Ventura County Fairgrounds. Vincenzo, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Well, finally, there's more to do this weekend than live music in your car.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran and Austin. Yes, it is Friday for those of you who might have lost track. But in this new norm, there are a ton of ways to spend the weekend that keeps you safe at home, away from the virus, and still entertained.
Okay, Leo, so what's something if I need a laugh?
All right, well, keep your jammies on for the adult version of Saturday morning cartoon shows. Tomorrow morning at 10:01 is 10:01 to 101. So
okay.
What this is, it's a streaming version of Channel 101. That's the formerly monthly short film fest that happened in downtown LA when we could do that sort of thing. It's co-created by Dan Harmon and Rob Schraub, who went on to make things like the TV shows Community and Rick and Morty. But this is a three-hour block where they'll be streaming some of the best from the fest. It's via Twitch every Saturday morning, and it's free.
Then what about something to do this weekend to make me smarter?
Okay, well, so you and I, we're both brown people, and you know how in the station's bathrooms, sometimes the sink's sensors don't turn on the water for us?
Yeah, that's a thing.
Yeah, that's an actual thing. Technology actually doesn't register darker skin all the time. Well, tomorrow, the Orange County Museum of Art screens online a documentary about this phenomenon, specifically in facial recognition software. So it explains how and why there's a bias in the programming that doesn't recognize dark skin and also sometimes women's faces. Here's a hint. Think about who's probably making those programs, people who are not dark-skinned or are not women. This event, it's called Cinema Orange Coded Bias, and you can watch it on your own time from tomorrow at noon until the end of the day. And it's free. Just head to the museum's website to RSVP and get the link.
Yeah, sometimes I got to run my hand around there a little bit before it notices. It's like, hey, hey, I'm here.
Yeah.
Finally, Leo, what's happening if I need some culture?
All right, so tomorrow morning, starting at 8, sit back and take in the full Ring Cycle by Wagner, performed by the LA Opera. It's part of their From the Vault series, and they'll be streaming past performances of all four parts of this epic opera based on Norse mythology. It'll be from dawn until dark, so you can tune in and out throughout the day, because when I say epic, this full thing is 15 hours. But it is famous in the opera world, and it's usually so famous that tickets to see it in person can be tough to come by. But for this one, you can check it out for free. It'll be available to watch on the opera's website and Facebook page. Now, there are still a bunch more events to go to while keeping you, your family, and your neighbors safe. To find out more, head to our site, laist.com. That is laist.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, at LeoHasACat.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks.
Thanks, Austin.
That's it for Take Two this week. Our producers are Leo Duran and Lori Skywalker-Galaretta. Lori also directed the show today, so thank you, Lori. Caroline Champlin helped us out with some producing earlier in the week. Marina Pena is our news apprentice. Darby Maloney edits the program. Take Two is engineered by Hazmik Pagosian. Our senior producer and editor is Megan Larson. And I'm Austin Cross, in for A. Martinez. And you can find me on Twitter, @AustinCross. We'll all be back here on Monday. Have a great weekend.